Chapter 11. Let's talk about sex. Zoe arrives for another session with Clara. She's warmly greeted and taken straight through to the comfortable therapy room. She kicks off her shoes and curls up in the comfortable recliner chair, takes a sip of her filtered water and wraps the big soft blanket around her legs. So how's your week been, Zoe?
Oh, it's been quite interesting. You know, the usual family drama.
Oh, tell me more.
I had a barbecue on Saturday and worked really hard to get it right. But somehow, it still ended up as a bit of a disaster.
What happened?
I fell asleep in the bath and had to let my sister and Miles in while sopping wet. Mitch ate Miles' T-bone steak. Rick arrived wrecked and ruined the place, and I had to throw him out before my dad and Miles killed him. I really did my best to get it all right. I'd even scrubbed the house till my fingers were raw. Was up at the crack of dawn to get it all ready. But it just seems that whatever I do, it all goes wrong. Something always happens to ruin it. All I wanted was a nice family gathering, a nice day with them. Instead, they all left early, and I ended up finishing off all the PIMS and woke up with a raging hangover.
Were there any positives?
Well, Zoe thinks hard.
It was wonderful to see the children. My house was spotless for a while, bar a few dog hairs.
And people did compliment my homemade sauce.
They said the food was great. I also did have a surprisingly good and honest conversation with my sister for once. Turns out she's going to see a therapist too.
Perhaps I'm not the only one screwed up.
But then she pauses and shakes her head.
Thing is, she said she was just going for a bit of self-improvement and to help her son.
What's up with her son?
All a bit concerned about him. He has trouble concentrating and the school's been complaining about his behaviour for a while. I think they're thinking of putting him on Ritalin.
I see how that could be concerning for everyone. But let's come back to the barbecue, Zoe. Are you telling me that you feel responsible for everything that happened that day?
Well, it was at my house. I invited them all. It was up to me to make it a good day. I should have known what would happen if I had them all in the same space together. But actually, I guess there were some good bits. And now you come to mention it, it wasn't all my fault. I can't take the blame for everything that happened. It's just the way my family are.
Zoe, Clara says, what is it you believe about your role in the family?
I've always been the peacemaker,
although it never seems to end up peaceful, to be honest. There's always some sort of argument eventually. So why do you think it's up to you to be the peacemaker?
I'm not sure. I just hate conflict and people getting upset. It really upsets me and then I have to do something about it. I've always been the only one who gets on with everyone individually, so they've always turned to me to be the go-between. And now it's just expected of me. I remember when I was little and my parents were fighting. I'd do something to get them to stop, even if it meant getting me into trouble.
Why so? Clara asks.
I'd rather they shouted at me than at each other. Even if they were united in anger at me, at least they were united. It worked most of the time.
Clara pauses and looks at her very intently. What I've noticed, Zoe, is when you're talking about this, you seem to shrink into yourself. How does it make you feel when you're trying to make things right and it doesn't work out?
I feel useless, terrible. And I end up going over and over it in my mind, wondering if I could have done or said something different.
That sounds exhausting.
Ugh, it is. Zoe takes a deep breath and sighs sadly.
So I'm curious. When you were growing up and looking after all of them, who was looking after you? Zoe just stares at her. This was something she hadn't thought about before, and it really took her aback.
Oh, well, no one, I guess. I didn't need anyone. I was very capable of sorting myself out. I took pride in that, and Mum always used to say that she never worried about me as I was the independent one. She assumed I was okay and didn't need her.
And were you okay?
I guess I had to be. I didn't have much choice. I mean, it never worried me when I was younger, as I didn't know any different. And I was always so busy trying to sort everyone else out. I was also really busy at school. I was determined to get good grades so I could get a good job and properly look after myself. I didn't want to have to rely on anyone else for anything.
Clara nods. Oh, so you were both the caretaker and the rescuer?
Yes, I suppose I was.
And how has playing those roles impacted on your life?
Zoe pauses to think about the question. I never thought about it before. But I suppose my job now is sort of the same thing, trying to rescue women who are in trouble, helping them to find some peace and stability in a mad world.
Do you sometimes struggle to believe that people, especially the ones in your family, could take care of themselves? Could manage without you?
Oh, I never really thought about it that way.
Well, it sounds as though you've managed to take care of yourself okay. So why couldn't others do the same?
I don't know, really, Zoe says, shaking her head.
I just see people struggling and I want to help.
Isn't that what you do? Especially when things are unfair and unjust. I can't help myself.
Has it ever occurred to you that by stepping in, you're giving people a message that says you think they're not capable? You're implying by your actions, subconsciously, that they're not good enough.
But that's not what I'm intending at all. I just want to help others.
And what about helping you? Where's the time to do that? It seems you spend so much time helping others, there's not a lot left for you. Zoe, I have to ask you, are you neglecting yourself?
What? No, I don't need anyone's help.
So let me get this straight. You don't need any help, but everyone else does. That's a very interesting belief, Zoe, don't you think?
Zoe looks a bit flabbergasted at this challenge.
She wasn't expecting this from Clara. So you've cast yourself in the role of Superwoman and saviour. Interesting.
No, that's not it at all.
Zoe is starting to get a little upset. Tell me what it is about, then.
It's just the way I am. I'm trying to be a good person.
Do good people totally ignore their own needs, Zoe?
Zoe is lost for words. It takes her a moment to respond. And when she does, it's clear that she's a little bit angry.
What needs? I'm fine.
Really?
Are you?
And remind me again why you're here.
Zoe is starting to get really emotional. Her bottom lip starts to wobble and she starts to cry.
Suddenly, the gateway to her inner frustrations opens up.
It's wide.
Because my love life is shit. And actually, I'm bloody sick of being walked all over, of carrying the shit for everyone else, for being the punchback for everyone, and the butt of people's sarcastic jokes. I'm sick of trying to do everything right, following stupid rules, driving myself crazy, trying to be the kind of woman people like and admire, that men want to be with, that family are proud of. And I'm really sick of being made to feel as though I'm inadequate because I don't have a boyfriend and told that I need to find a man to love me. Because the bottom line is, not only do I not even like myself, I have no idea how to fix this.
Oh my God. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm so embarrassed. She grabs for some tissues.
You must think I'm awful. God, I never cry in front of people and now I feel like a total loser.
Zoe, this is the first time I've heard your authentic voice and what you really think of yourself. That was wonderful. Well done.
Really? Zoe says, now looking aghast and looking very much like a panda bear with makeup running down her face.
Clara reaches into a drawer and hands her some more tissues.
Don't ever apologise for speaking your truth, and definitely don't apologise for crying. I was waiting for you to get real, and you just did.
You don't think I was being real before?
I think you were being who you thought you were meant to be, or should be, and not you. This is a safe place for you to be authentic, Zoe. It's time for you to recognise how hard you've been on yourself. It's time for you to let this go and start to support you. You won't find support in the outside world if it doesn't begin within you. I think it's time for an exercise. Are you up for it?
Zoe nods and blows her nose noisily into her tissue.
Oh my God, yes. I really need to sort this out. All right, let's do it.
Clara smiles. She gets up and moves a full-length mirror on wheels in front of Zoe. She asks her to stand up and really study her reflection.
Okay, Zoe, I want you to speak openly about exactly what you see and what you think of yourself. I need you to be really honest. Don't hold back. Say it all. I want you to bring to the surface all the things you say to yourself, the things that are usually hidden inside your head.
Zoe takes a long time staring into the mirror. It takes a while for her to get over her self-consciousness, but she can feel an irritation building up. It's as if a tidal wave of emotion and shame is rising. When she finally opens her mouth, she finds that she cannot hold herself back.
Zoe, you are a fucking idiot, a bloody loser. Look at the state of you. You never get anything right. You can't even do a bloody barbecue. You mess everything up. I'm not surprised that no one wants you. You're ugly, clumsy, untidy, a half-wit. You say the wrong things. You drink too much. You're always getting wasted. You wake up with hangovers all the time. You're not funny. You're pretty pathetic. You tell lies. You're always people-pleasing and saying things you don't mean. I'm surprised you have any friends at all. The ones you do have probably feel sorry for you. You're just so boring, you even bore yourself. Emma is probably right. I'm a car crash. Total car crash. Couldn't even organise a piss up in a brewery. Couldn't even make the meal with that stupid Robert without getting pissed. No wonder he hasn't called. Doesn't want to see me again. Zoe, I really hate you right now. Okay, says Clara. Anything else? I think there's more. Don't stop now. Keep going. Say it all. She takes a deep breath. You're such a fake. You make out you're so clever, even when you can't even hold down a boyfriend. Even Sam has a man and you can't get anyone to stay with you. Stupid, dumbass. You keep making the same stupid mistakes over and over again. You're a complete and utter fucking idiot. You're getting old and soon no one will ever want you. Even Mitch thinks you're a loser. I actually hate you. I'm so over you right now. Ugh, I just hate you. She turns to Clara and sighs deeply. I think that's everything. Are you sure? Oh, I'm sure. I'm done. But holy shit, I can't go on like this. What the hell? I need to change this, not just for a boyfriend. I need to change it for me. Enough is enough. I'm so ready. Can you help me change this? Oh yes, that's why we're here. And well done, Zoe. The work has well and truly begun. Okay, so where do I start? Clara hands her a journal. Now that you've released some of those inner emotions and got a sense of how you've been beating yourself up in the background, I want you to know that this journal is going to be your new best friend. I want you to make a note of your thoughts and feelings throughout the day, especially when something triggers you or you're feeling any kind of emotions, especially the bad ones. I want you to make a note of what you say to yourself when things don't go so well, all of the names you call yourself. That's in the front of the book. At the back of the book, at the back of the journal, I want you to do the opposite. I want you to make note of any good things that happen. I also want you to list a nice, positive thing that you do for yourself each day. Like what? Says Zoe. You tell me. What do you enjoy? There must be some little pampering things that you could do. They don't have to cost the earth. It could be as simple as running yourself a hot bath and listening to your favourite music. Get creative, Zoe. I want a full report when you come next week. Zoe leaves, feeling somehow lighter, optimistic, energised, and excited about the week ahead. Meanwhile, in Wigmore Street, central London, Harriet Mason, a psychoanalyst, is in her reception. She had begun her career in Harley Street, but moved several years ago when it became associated with plastic surgeons, cosmetic enhancements, and what she considered to be charlatans. She shares the building with other psychiatrists and medical professionals who recognise the need for understated yet suitably impressive surroundings. She's admonishing her personal assistant Rebecca and her cleaner Razia, who doesn't speak much English. Harriet is tall, slender, in her mid-50s with an austere countenance. Her hair is scraped back tightly in a very neat bun. She's wearing a tweed skirt suit and no accessories other than a watch and a pair of round gold-framed glasses, which she's worn since the mid-80s. Her look is unchanged. It was cemented when she graduated, and she has seen no reason to change it. She's been trained to give nothing away about herself, which is in keeping with who she is anyway. She comes from a long line of doctors and decided to specialise in psychoanalysis rather than psychiatry, as she was a huge admirer of Sigmund Freud and his work. She's read his entire works and is decidedly anti-Jung, thinking him far too esoteric, and was a traitor to the psychoanalytical tradition. She thinks Joseph Campbell is way off the mark too. She prefers Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, who both stress self-reliance and not being a slave to desires. She's a purist by nature, mildly OCD, something she's explored in therapy and is still working on, but is devoted to her craft. She lives alone with her Burmese cat, has few friends, all of them psychoanalysts, and has brief strategic meetings with her family when she must. She decided long ago that she was asexual, interested in neither men nor women, finding relationships and sex messy, chaotic, distracting and problematic. She much prefers to be an observer of human nature and to be of assistance to damaged and defective souls who need her. She thinks everyone would benefit from her skills, Unfortunately, not everyone has the intellectual capacity to meet the rigours of the psychoanalytical process, though. Her office is equally as austere. The walls are white, the curtains beige, usually drawn, and one abstract picture of a square in beige and white adorns the wall. She has a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf full of psychoanalytical texts, including the entire works of Freud and several books of her own. A solitary green plant is the only other decoration. She has a large oak-polished desk with nothing on it but a large notepad and a telephone. She has a large, dark brown wing-backed chair for herself and a long, dark brown leather couch for her patients. She's completely dedicated, and when not doing psychoanalysis, is reading about it. She has written and published many papers in peer-reviewed journals and is considered to be an eminent practitioner in her field. This is one of the reasons for Emma choosing her. Her fees are very high to dissuade the dabblers, and she insists on setting out at least a 2-year plan with people and often sees them more than once a week. She arrives at her office every morning at 7 a.m, and this morning is no different. Her cleaner is scheduled to arrive at 6:15 a.m. to ensure the place is spotless and that everything, including the clock on the wall, is exactly where it's meant to be. She doesn't believe in small talk or chit-chat, preferring to get straight to the point and straight to work. She's not happy when she enters the room because her plant has been moved and is not in its correct place. She proceeds to explain to Rebecca the importance of consistency and precision, so she's under no doubt of what is expected from her and the rest of the staff. I have invested a small fortune and years of my life to clinical training. My patients are entirely reliant on me. They are sometimes hanging on by a thread to life, and I deal with fractured psyches, wounded people, and extreme fragility. I become the thread that keeps them connected to life itself. I simply can't have anything not in the right place. It provides safety for them. Do you understand? Sometimes I'm their only connection to the world, and I have to be mother and father to them. So I need you to make sure that everything is back where it's meant to be, in exactly the same position. This could potentially be a matter of life and death sometimes, so it's imperative that you get it right. She pauses and looks at them both. Do you understand? Razia's grasp of English has improved in the 6 months since she's been in England, but she's not quite able to fully understand everything that's being said. She gets the gist from Harriet's expression and body language, so she nods politely and pretends she does. Emma arrives on the dot of 11 a.m. She had selected Harriet in the same way she selects everything: exclusivity, reputation, and status. Harriet had come recommended by her private GP, and the fact that she was one of the most expensive led her to believe that she was going to be the best. The receptionist, Rebecca, ushers her in. She's very professional. She isn't entirely convinced by Harriet's methods or by the way she treats people, but the job pays well and she's learning a lot just by being there. In her own time, she's training to be a life coach. She believes in more direct and practical methods. But she knocks on Harriet's door to let her know her patient has arrived. Miss Mason, Emma Gu Montague is here to see you. Thank you, send her in. Emma enters and is told to sit down on a long leather couch. Harriet is unsmiling. Okay, let me tell you about the way I work so we are clear from the start. I have a Freudian, Kleinian, psychoanalytical orientation. Emma nods respectfully. Psychoanalysis is a form of psychotherapy. It's a talking therapy where you may engage in uncensored free speech, allowing you to bring what is buried within the unconscious into full consciousness. This includes that which has been repressed, suppressed, and inhibited. I believe this to be the root cause of all psychological dysfunctions. Psychoanalysis is recommended when the problem is deeply rooted in character and personality structure, because other forms of talking therapy can't get deeply enough into the roots, which are connected to childhood experiences and particularly traumas. How long are we looking at here? Asks Emma, tentatively. In our terms, 2 years would be the briefest engagement. It can take a considerable amount of time to reveal what's been hidden. Okay, and how does it work? Emma asks. Well, not all analysts use it, but I prefer to use the couch in my sessions. This triangulates the therapeutic relationship. I will sit behind you as you lie on the couch, so we can both observe your inner material as though projected on the wall. This includes all the elements of your life, including your relationship with me. This makes it easier for you to access your dreams and fantasies. What if I don't have any fantasies? Emma says, a little concerned. Oh, these will emerge with the process. Don't worry. You just need to trust me in this. Being on the couch will enable you to be a little less focused on the day-to-day reality and connect with your unmet needs, feelings and desires that have been repressed or latent. I see, says Emma, not really seeing it at all. As an intelligent, logical woman, you will already have a sense of understanding with regards to who you are and what has led you to be where you are. But it is what lies within your subconscious that we need to explore. In particular, we will look at your dreams. Freud said that they were the royal road to the unconscious, and this is why dream work is so important. Emma nods. Some of this does match her expectations and her previous research. We will decode your dreams to look for meanings and their significance. We will be looking at your daydreams too. Neuroses often occurs because people have deep-seated anger and unresolved trauma. When not dealt with, it can transfigure into depression and anxiety. We'll also be looking at your attachments, particularly in regard to your mother and the pre-Oedipal stages of your life. Emma is not entirely sure what this is, but fully intends to research it once she leaves. She's sure it's very important. We will be exploring your psychic reality from multiple points of view, following the traditions of the great thinkers of psychoanalysis. I stand very firmly on the shoulders of the giants that have gone before me, such as Freud and Klein. Emma smiles. She feels assured that she's in good hands and that soon she will be feeling better. The main goal of psychoanalytic therapy is to enhance the functioning of your ego, helping you, the individual, to become less controlled by distracting biological drives or demands of your superego, Harriet continues. Emma looks a little perturbed because, actually, it is precisely these distracting biological needs that have led her to seek help. A psychoanalytic treatment is not undertaken for the purpose of getting rid of a single problematic item. It aims at refashioning and re-educating your entire person. Regular sessions and commitment are essential to ensure an optimal outcome. If you really want to get results, you'll need to come at least twice a week, preferably three times, and the time frame's open-ended but will most likely be measured in years. At the very least two, as I said. Now, not everyone is a suitable candidate for the rigours of psychoanalysis. But I do believe, having read your initial application, that you would be ideal. Inwardly, Emma gasps at the idea of the time and commitment required, but is flattered nonetheless, and is determined to live up to Harriet's expectations. So what actually happens in the sessions? Asks Emma bravely. We're going to explore the potentially fantasy-laden distortion of your reality. And I shall be just like a surgeon, extracting a tumour. I will reach into your mind and correct these distortions via my interpretations. I will create for you a mirror onto which you'll project your fantasies, mental illusions and transferences. I will reflect them back to you in the form of interpretations, and once there is nothing left to project, we will consider our work done. Harriet, ever the purist, was giving Emma as much detail as possible in what she considered to be layman's terms. And although full of trepidation, Emma is definitely ready to start the clinical work. Do you think it's possible to be happy again? Harriet pauses for what seems like a very long time. So what does happy again mean to you? I'm not sure. Just to feel normal, the same as everyone else, like I used to. To connect with my husband the way I used to. If I'm honest, we're not so intimate anymore and we don't have much sex these days. So what does normal mean for you? And is it important for you to be the same as everyone else, Emma? Well, you know, just normal as in, well... Emma is now starting to wonder exactly what normal really is. Harriet, meanwhile, is sat silently behind her, letting her ponder and making notes on her pad. This goes on for quite some time. Emma is just about to give a considered and thoughtful reply when she's interrupted by Harriet. Okay, thank you, Emma. Your time is up for today. I think this has been an excellent beginning and I know that we're going to work well together and you will get much out of it. We'll continue next time. Please make arrangements for your next session in a couple of days with Rebecca. She'll be waiting for you in the reception now. Emma gets up from the couch. She's a little disorientated. However, she senses that she mustn't take up any more of Harriet's time. She leaves the room murmuring her goodbyes and hoping that she's made a good impression. She's not entirely sure what she's letting herself in for. All she knows is that it sounds very impressive and she's looking forward to getting some answers and some resolutions. Rebecca greets her with a warm smile. Everything go okay? Emma smiles and nods. I think so. It looks like it's going to be a long road, but I'm sure it'll be well worth the effort. Rebecca smiles back professionally, not betraying an ounce of her ambiguous feelings about this way of working. She just hopes that Emma can find what she needs pretty quickly. She hates to see anyone wasting their time and money. She offers Emma several appointment options, and Emma commits to 2 regular late morning slots each week. Emma leaves feeling a little mind-boggled, but somewhat relieved at having survived her first session. She feels a little down and isn't entirely sure why. The traffic is terrible, and she's too impatient to sit in it, so she decides to take the tube rather than her customary taxi. On her way, she passes one of her favourite high-end boutiques. She decides to go in and have a browse, insisting that it's just to cheer herself up. She ends up spending a small fortune on a new designer Italian handmade handbag and matching shoes. She leaves feeling much better.